This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, President Biden announced federal action to cancel some student loan debt this week. We'll find out who it affects, how it works, and what it means for the future of higher education. Now it's time for Food Friday. Our guest says he likes food that's loud and hits you over the head. Some samples: lobster tostadas, fried bologna sandwiches with salt and vinegar potato chips, and triple-decker hot pastrami and coleslaw sandwiches. In his New Orleans restaurant, Turkey and the Wolf, he features creative mishmashes of Southern classics and offbeat gas station favorites. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's focus in on those sandwiches. Do you have a favorite sandwich of all time, one that you made or a parent made or that you got at a restaurant? Do you like to incorporate what other people might see as weird stuff into your sandwiches? What questions do you have about Southern cooking? Do you have some guilty pleasure food that you love to make and maybe you don't even feel that guilty about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mason Hereford is a chef and author of Turkey and the Wolf, Flavor Trippin' in New Orleans, which compiles recipes from his New Orleans restaurant of the same name. Mason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm pumped.
Me too. And here's why. Before we get into the food, you know, I know running a restaurant's hard work and cooking can be a chore, but one thing I really took away from your book is, I think, you want us to have fun cooking, right?
Yeah, that's the whole idea. You know, we opened our sandwich shop in New Orleans, Turkey and the Wolf, with that being like, you know, a main concern of ours is how to get work done, run a, you know, a profitable restaurant to a certain degree, but more importantly, how to have fun and show up to work every day. And that was the same sort of idea behind writing a cookbook. It's, you know, show people there's fun to be had out there and try to give them access to that fun.
One of your inspirations, you write, is sandwiches and other foods you picked up at gas stations growing up as a kid. Can you talk about that source of your culinary inspiration?
Sure. You know, that just happens to be my most formative food memories at the sort of the youngest age. Would be the gas station down the street, down the road from my house, because I kind of grew up out in the country. And, you know, everybody, I imagine, has these memories of when they were young and the things they used to eat. And I'm, you know, some of the biggest and earliest flavor explosions in my memories were like bags of Doritos and, you know, cans of Pringles and Coca-Cola and junk food that's bad for you. But obviously, like, the flavors dialed up to 10. So maybe those are why they stick in my head. And I'm not sure I'm like a guy that just mixes junk food together, but I will say, I think that I like big flavors, and a lot of that might be because of the food I grew up eating.
Now, you focus on sandwiches a lot, and I love a good sandwich. I often order sandwiches at restaurants, but when I make a sandwich at home, I don't know, it's like a plan B or a default, and I don't have respect sometimes for the sandwiches. Pump me up for some respect for sandwich making at home.
Yeah, you know, not the first time I've talked, I've had the conversation about respecting sandwiches. I think every culture has their hand foods and their street foods that are awesome. One cool thing about the sandwich is that you're going to eat the same bite over and over again. So, you know, you really got to think about it. And to put a few things onto a plate, you can play off each other. You know, if you've got like mashed potatoes and gravy and peas and turkey on Thanksgiving or whatever, you can have a bite with this on it, a bite with that, mix and match. The sandwich is the same bite over and over again. So I think it really requires you to be thoughtful about what you're eating. Because you don't want to get bored and you want to make sure you nail it. So building a sandwich, I think, can oftentimes be more pressure than just putting some things on a plate.
Now, sometimes on Food Friday, I see a piece of practical advice and my head explodes and I'm like, I want to go home right now and try it. This one is so basic, but okay. So I make a sandwich at home. I either have the bread, you know, I guess raw, or I put it in the toaster. No. You want us to roast it in a pan, let it breathe. Tell us what goes into getting that bread ready and why you do it that way.
Yeah, I think, you know, seeing as there is only one component that's on every sandwich, and that would be the sandwich, the bread, the thing you're sandwiching with. And the bread is very important. So, you know, there's other conversations about how to select your bread and how to think of it as an actual ingredient. But for a lot of sandwiches, I find, you know, buttered toast is a very delectable sandwich ingredient. When I'm using white bread, which is in this cookbook, I think a good portion of sandwiches, maybe half of them, are on, you know, thick cut buttered white bread. And the idea, white bread toast, the idea there is you cut it thick because you want to be able to toast it and get two textures out of it. You want it crispy on the outside and sort of soft on the middle is how I like it. And to achieve that, I like to toast in a pan because the butter melts and caramelizes and it gets a crisp crust on the outside of the bread. And then on the inside, it can be kind of steamed and chewy and nice. But when you take it out of the pan, if you were to just throw it onto a cutting board and start layering it with ingredients, we found this out quickly at our restaurant the week we opened. My friend Colleen actually thought this up, is if you give the bread a chance to breathe by putting it on a resting rack or sort of leaning it up against each other like an A-frame, you can give it time to, like, I don't know, breathe, as you said. So get some airflow around there, and then the crispy outside stays crispy. So when you put the ingredients on there, it sort of has that that base structural integrity to slop things on top and still have, like, toast texture on the outside of the bread. But on the inside, if you cut it thick enough, we'll have that nice, like, chew that you want out of sandwich bread as well.
It's Food Friday. We're getting great sandwich making advice from Mason Hereford. He has a restaurant in New Orleans called Turkey and the Wolf and a new cookbook called Turkey and the Wolf, Flavor Trippin' in New Orleans. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your favorite sandwich of all time, or maybe a sandwich that went wrong. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Ross is with us now in Middleton. Ross, hi.
Hi, Rob and Nathan. I've been to New Orleans for the Jazz Fest, and the restaurants down there are phenomenal. And I'm looking forward. I'm hoping to get up there, get there next year and check out your sandwich shop. So I was down somewhere down in the near the French Quarter, whatever, and I thought, oh, I'm going to get myself a shrimp po' boy, and kind of looking forward to it. And when I got it, I was sort of left wanting. It was like there just wasn't much there. It was some bread, some shrimp, and I don't know if there was much else on there. What is a po' boy, and do you make them?
Ross, thanks for the call. Well, Mason, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think what you have hit on is not all po' boys are the same. And there are, like any sandwiches, there are places that make them surprisingly well. And then there's places that, you know, maybe fall short because of a number of reasons. Maybe it was a more touristy spot, which sometimes there are downtown. There's also a lot of gems downtown in the French Quarter. But what a po' boy is traditionally is either a fried seafood or a roast beef sandwich. And there's a few other types of po' boy, but that's what you're going to traditionally see. It all comes down to the French bread. It's going to be on 6, 8, or 12-inch French bread. And French bread in New Orleans is made a certain way and has a certain crumb and texture and crust. So that's very important to the sandwich. And then on top of that, you're going to have your central ingredients, and everyone dresses them differently. But you order your po' boy dressed, which a lot of times will mean lettuce, tomato, pickles, onions, plus or minus one or two of those ingredients, and then mayonnaise and hot sauce, or mayonnaise and ketchup if it's going to be with fried seafood or roast beef. But it sounds like yours didn't have enough sauce, or maybe the seafood didn't have enough seasoning or something to make it all pop, because a really good shrimp po' boy, in my opinion, is hard to beat. But to answer your question about whether I make them, I do not make them. In New Orleans, we saw a very serious opportunity to open a sandwich shop that wasn't a po' boy shop, because we had so many po' boy shops, but not so many just clear sandwich shops that make non-po' boys.
Ross, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's meet one of those not po' boys. The Bel Air is one of the – this one sounds really good. It's a ham sandwich. I think you call it the ham sandwich of your dreams. Tell us the story of the Bel Air.
So the Bel Air is named after some gas station outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, the town I grew up in the middle of Virginia. There is a gas station called The Market at Bel Air. We called it the Bel Air Market. But it's between where I grew up and getting into the city proper. So when we were driving into town, as we referred to it, I would often stop at this gas station and get one of their amazing sandwiches, my favorite of which is this one. It was called the Jefferson there, and it was made with turkey. We reinterpreted it as a ham sandwich that we've named in the cookbook as the Bel Air, which is ham that we often make in-house. Not so much anymore, but whatever. An herb mayonnaise, aged cheddar cheese, arugula, and cranberry sauce. And it's a very faithful representation of the one I grew up eating like two or three times a week on a good week in Charlottesville, Virginia at Bel Air Market.
And did I read this right? The Bel Air Market now has named a sandwich after you?
Yeah, you know, at first I got a little heat. People were like, you know, this sandwich shop is getting a slight acclaim, and they've clearly ripped off a sandwich from their hometown and talk about it as if they'd done nothing wrong. And I did talk to them about it. And since then, they've discussed that they're so happy and proud to see the sandwich in a new city and it doing well. And they have done something I found very exciting, which is put a bologna sandwich on their menu after one of our best sellers. And they named it A Touch of Mason, which was an honor to have.
We're talking to Chef Mason Hereford about his new cookbook. It's called Turkey and the Wolf, Flavor Trippin' in New Orleans, featuring quirky twists on some Southern classics, especially sandwiches. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Our guest is a sandwich connoisseur. Are you? Do you have a favorite sandwich or a problem? You know, they're always better when somebody else makes it for you, right? Well, maybe you need an extra tip, a secret to make your sandwiches better. Share your favorites, share your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Maybe a nostalgic sandwich favorite from your childhood. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Chef Mason Hereford about his new cookbook, Turkey and the Wolf, Flavor Trippin' in New Orleans. Lots of great sandwich advice, especially from his restaurant, Turkey and the Wolf in New Orleans. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a nostalgic childhood favorite sandwich? Do you have a nostalgic current favorite sandwich you love to make, or at least love to eat? Whoever makes it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Dan is with us in Wisconsin Dells. Dan, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us, Dan?
Well, when I was a kid coming home from school in the summertime, we always had cucumbers. So I would take cucumbers that were in mayonnaise along with a little bit of vinegar, put it on some nice thick toast, and then drizzle it with A1 sauce, and it was probably one of my favorite sandwiches, and I still make it today.
You still make it today. Now, do other people like it when you make it, or is it all about that nostalgia for you?
I don't think anybody else would like it. It's just all nostalgia.
That sounds like a pretty good combination to me, Dan. How about you, Mason?
I mean, I think it sounds nice and balanced. I'll have to give it a try.
Fantastic, Dan. I love it. And I remember my fridge sandwich was, I loved when we had leftover meatloaf and making a meatloaf sandwich with a whole bunch of barbecue sauce on it. Can you talk, Mason, about how you go about, like, I don't know, being a mad scientist a little bit like this and finding ingredients that go well together on a sandwich?
I'm very lucky to work with an amazing team of cooks in the kitchen at both of our restaurants. And we like to sort of start with one idea in mind, and maybe there's a leader who takes a dish in a certain direction, but we all like to work together to bounce ideas off each other. Because a lot of times if you, as you mentioned, have a dish that's nostalgic to you, it might not be as presentable to the general populace in the same way. So we try to make everything a team effort, build ideas off each other, and you know, the more brains you have at the table, the more interesting a concoction you can come up with, in my opinion.
Thanks again for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Danielle is with us now in La Crosse. Danielle, hi.
Hi. So my story is that this was something that my dad made, and I've never heard it anywhere else, and I don't know why it ever became a thing, but whenever we would have Hamburger Helper as kids, he would always have bread and creamy peanut butter on the table, and you would make peanut butter bread, two slices, and then you put Hamburger Helper in the middle of it, and you'd eat it like a sandwich.
Okay, you did that as a kid, Danielle. Have you done it as a grown-up?
I have not. I don't eat meat anymore.
Oh,
so,
okay. That'll kill the Hamburger Helper.
I will have to ask my dad if he still makes that.
Danielle, fantastic. Now, that might sound weird to people, but hang on. You've got a not yo mama's peanut butter bacon burger. Mason, beef and peanut butter can live happily together?
That is a fact. Beef and peanut butter, especially with bacon, in my opinion, is an excellent combination. And I would not be against a peanut butter and Hamburger Helper sandwich.
Fantastic, Danielle. Thanks for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Mason, a theme in a lot of your recipes is the abundant use of mayonnaise. And I guess I've had a mayonnaise conversion. I'm from the Midwest. I like mayonnaise, you know, and I like water, right? But I've just in the last couple of years learned to like really like mayonnaise and do cool stuff and use it in different things. Can you talk about how you like to use mayo?
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of good jokes there that I'm going to stay away from. But we use mayonnaise for all sorts of things. Obviously on a lot of our sandwiches and a lot of our sauces for sandwiches are mayonnaise with cool ingredients mixed in, whether it be purees or hot sauces or pestos or this and that. Other things we use mayonnaise for, let me think here. Oh, I put a little mayonnaise in the ceviche recipe in the book. It's actually an agua chile, and it's based on a Peruvian idea. I had a Peruvian ceviche once that had a little bit of mayonnaise in there for creamy texture. I also put a tiny bit of mayonnaise in a white bean hummus to add to the creamy texture, and that one was sort of hilariously on brand for us. I'm trying to think. You can bake with mayonnaise. I know that there's different cake ideas that have mayonnaise in there. The possibilities are endless. Also, if you have a sauce that breaks, it can help re-emulsify sauces.
Oh, that's great. Fantastic. Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Mason Hereford on Food Friday. His new cookbook is called Turkey and the Wolf, Flavor Trippin' in New Orleans. Karen is with us now in Madison. Karen, hi.
Hi. I'm originally from Madison here in Wisconsin, but lived in Boston for 35 years, and I am thoroughly addicted to Fluffernutter sandwiches, which is peanut butter and marshmallow fluff. The, you know, it's marshmallow cream, but it's the brand Fluff. And you put them both together, and you have a Fluffernutter sandwich.
I got to ask, Karen, is this a main course or is it a dessert?
Well, that depends on how addicted you get to it. It's sweet. It's awfully sweet. But it's awfully good.
Karen, thanks a lot for that. Mason, do you do sweet sandwiches that might cross the line into a dessert sandwich?
Sure, why not? I'm down with a fluffernutter. That sounds delicious. I might make one right after this.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot, Karen. Joanne joins us now in Madison. Joanne, hi.
Hi. Ever since I was a child, we always put when we make a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich, we make it on toast. We put peanut butter on the toast first, and you put the bacon on top of the peanut butter and continue making the sandwich the way you like it, with or without mayo. And it's delicious, and I have converted so many friends to eating peanut butter and peanut butter BLTs.
Interesting. Joanne, thanks a lot for that. And we've got another caller, I think, who's thinking about peanut butter on their sandwiches. Mason, this takes me, I don't know, I think we get locked into, we keep doing our sandwiches the same way again and again, and we're hearing people here, and you, of course, getting creative. Do you have thoughts on encouraging the rest of us to try something different that we might, you know, initially turn our noses up at on our sandwiches?
Yeah, you know, I think variety is the spice of life, honestly. And I also think there's a lot of really great savory uses for peanut butter. Peanut butter BLT sounds perfect, in my opinion. But yeah, I think that it's easy to fall into that trap that a sandwich is like exactly what you expect it to be. And I always encourage people to get weird. I say let your freak flag fly on this one.
Hey, I want to check out one more sandwich. Actually, we had a caller earlier who said she doesn't eat meat anymore. So this is one for her, I think. A melt sandwich, a collard melt, collard greens. Can you tell us about how this one comes together?
Yeah, so the collard green sandwich, or the collard green melt, as we call it, is tied with our most popular sandwich that we serve. I've been lucky enough to cook it in other countries even. It's been really fun. But basically, it's served triple-decker, almost like a club sandwich. But other than that, there is no overlap. What we have is seeded rye bread, three thinner slices of seeded rye bread that's toasted and on a griddle, Swiss cheese melted, stewed collard greens that we have a recipe in the cookbook that we, you know, over the years, we found out our very specific way that we love to make them for this sandwich. We do a Russian dressing that contains chopped up pickled cherry peppers and coleslaw. And the whole thing, when you eat it together, almost tastes like a vegetarian, like soul food version of a Reuben sandwich. And it's definitely one of our most popular dishes for sure.
That sounds fantastic. And Mason, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was fun.
That's Mason Hereford, chef and owner of restaurants in New Orleans. He talked to us about his cookbook named after one of those restaurants. It's called Turkey and the Wolf, Flavor Trippin' in New Orleans. Hey, still time for you to share your all-time sandwich favorites, and seem to have struck a nerve if you put peanut butter on sandwiches that most people wouldn't expect you to put peanut butter on. We want to hear about it. You can email us, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR with your favorite sandwich creations. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, the election review led by former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman appears to be over after Assembly Speaker Robin Voss fired Gableman. What came out of it all? Take a look at the long saga and join in with your thoughts, your questions. That's The Morning Show. It's coming up Monday morning at 7:30. Check it out here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the Friday News Roundup. President Biden announces a student loan forgiveness program. In Florida, voters pick a former governor to take on the current one. And the tracks of a 15-foot dinosaur are revealed in Texas. Those stories and more today at 6 on the 1A Weekly News Roundup. Now, the Biden administration on Wednesday took at least a bite out of the roughly $1.6 trillion in cumulative federal student loan debt. The president announced loan forgiveness of between $10,000 and $20,000, depending on the current salary of debt holders and whether or not they'd received a Pell Grant. We're going to look at how this would all work, what effects it might have, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this move, good idea or not? Does it have an effect on you personally? Are you not sure if it affects you personally and you want to find out? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nicholas Hillman is a professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. He directs the Student Success through Applied Research Lab at UW. Nick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, there have been calls for no debt forgiveness, calls for complete debt forgiveness. On the scale of none to all, where does this fit in, big picture?
It fits kind of in a sweet spot, really, right in the middle of the two, because it is not such widespread forgiveness that it makes more conservative members of Congress too worrisome, I suppose. Or maybe, well, they might still be very worrisome, but it's not too much from that vantage point. But then on the farther left end of the political distribution among progressives, it wasn't enough. And so the $10,000 for most borrowers and then up to 20 for borrowers who had a Pell Grant was kind of a compromise.
Can you talk about the debt forgiveness part of it in particular? Give us some more of the details, 10 for some, 20,000 for others, but there's also an income cap. Can you talk us through the basics of who is going to be affected by this?
There are two different things to keep in mind. One is certainly the income cap. If you're an individual with an annual income of $125,000 or less, then you would qualify. If you're in a household that has $250,000 or less, then you would qualify. So that's the first condition. But the second condition is whether you have a direct loan. And so if you took out a loan basically since 2010 forward, those are typically going to be direct loans. But there's some old loans that have been out there for a very long time prior to 2010 that might not qualify. So the first step is also to make sure you have an eligible loan.
Do you have a sense of, on a practical level, how people start finding out if they're eligible and start requesting this debt forgiveness?
Right. So there are two different places to go. One is directly to the federal government, the U.S. Department of Education. The website has been overloaded the last couple of days, so you might have to be patient to get the website to load. But the U.S. Department of Education, the Office of Federal Student Aid is the place to go there. You could log in and check your records, or you could go in through what's called a student loan servicer. So some servicers that might be familiar are Great Lakes or Navient. These servicers are the ones who are supposed to be kind of the connector between the federal government and the borrower.
Talking to Nicholas Hillman from UW-Madison, looking at the Biden administration announcement of some student loan debt forgiveness. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to that decision, your questions about what it is, how it works, maybe what it means for you. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Now, that debt forgiveness is kind of the high-profile part of this. There's also, from the Department of Education, a transition to something called income-driven repayment plans. What does that mean? How does it work?
Well, the Department of Education has had different types of income-driven repayment plans over the years, and each new iteration, they become a little bit more generous. Basically, what these do is they connect your monthly student loan payment to your earnings. And they cap that amount to a certain level. And so the new proposal or the new income-driven repayment plan that was just announced this week would cap monthly payments to 5% of what's called your discretionary income. Discretionary income is just basically income above the poverty level, plus or minus some other proportion. But that's the idea, is that they're going to cap monthly payments, but also, more generous than other plans, this will forgive certain loans after 10 years of making payments. In some of the other income-driven plans that exist, those forgiveness programs are 20 or 25 years later. So hopefully that helps give an idea of what these are.
Now, we have a lot of student loan debt in the United States. Can you talk about what we know about student loan debt among Wisconsin residents?
We know a few things. For example, there are about 700,000 Wisconsin residents with direct loans, the federal loans that are going to be eligible here for this cancellation. So about 700,000 people, and they carry about $21 billion in student loan debt. That adds up to about a $31,000 on average is what a student debt holder has in the state of Wisconsin.
How did we get here? Big picture, what changed in higher education funding priorities, higher education costs that drove this increase in student loan debt over the last couple few decades?
Yeah, there's a whole mix of things. On one hand, the expenses of college, the tuition and the room and the board, just the expenses of going to college has continued to rise over the past 20, 30 years. In fact, it's doubled just since the 90s and even higher in some places. So that's a big part of it. Another part of it, though, that makes college more expensive on the first hand. But another part of it is that family incomes haven't really grown as fast. And so individuals can't just pay out of pocket for college, so they have to rely on student loans. Another side to this, though, is that the federal and state financial aid programs that are designed to reduce those price barriers by giving out grants and scholarships, those haven't kept pace either. And so you kind of have this mix of a situation where more borrowers are relying on loans over time. They're relying on more loans to pay for college. And it doesn't help that the interest rates that are accrued in loan programs have also been rising. So we have a whole kind of slew of issues that have created this ballooning amount of student loan debt now nationally of almost $1.7 trillion.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Vivian is with us in Brown County. Vivian, hi.
Been a while, but I was going to bring up the interest rate as well as the fact that some loans aren't wiped out even through bankruptcy. But the interest rates, when my daughter was looking for loans and I was comparing those, I said, that's just silly. They're more than mortgage rates. And why are they like that? And she reminded me she had no collateral, obviously. So I think the structure of the loans, the interest rates, I wonder of that total that you mentioned for total student loan debt, how much of that is interest?
Vivian, thanks for the call. Nick, the structure of these loans, Vivian says, has been a problem.
That's right. To answer that last question with a non-answer, we don't know how much of the outstanding debt is interest versus principal. So that's part of the challenge. Some things that the Biden administration has been working on is to put caps on the amount of interest that can accumulate. So that should at least address part of the problem. But I think a bigger problem, and Vivian mentioned this, saying that this thing about no collateral. Unlike most any other loans that people take out in America, you know, there's collateral. If you take out a car loan, the repossession man will come to your house and take the car away if you don't make your payments. So, you know, there's something to be taken away. But for education, that's not the case. They can't take your education away from you. And so because of that, it's a really unconventional type of way to finance an education. And it's based off of a model that was designed in the 1950s and 60s that may have worked, and maybe we're realizing today that this type of financing system isn't quite aligned with how human nature works.
Thanks for that call, Vivian. Don joins us now in Janesville. Don, hello.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm kind of getting on board with Vivian. My girlfriend's Pell Grant is about $12,500, you know, from almost 20 years ago. And the interest is about $62,000. So I was just wondering, is this if it goes through and they take, you know, they wash the primary money away, does the interest go away too, or do you know how that's going to work out? How is that going to happen?
Interesting, Don. Thanks for the call, Nick.
That is a great question because there are a lot of unknowns at this point. I assume that it would be the principal and the interest outstanding. I would assume that that is what is going to be covered, but that has not been explicit in the press releases and the announcements that I've been reading. I've been keeping up with this week. So they haven't been really explicit about that difference, I would assume, but gosh, that should be clear.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Nick Hillman, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison, looking at the announcement earlier this week from President Biden that the administration is canceling from $10,000 to $20,000 of federal student loan debt for borrowers who make under a certain amount of money. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about that move? Too much? Not enough? Does it affect you? Do you have questions? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about President Biden's announcement earlier this week about canceling a substantial portion of student loan debt. Nick Hillman stays with us, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to the announcement, your questions about it. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Allison is with us in Stevens Point. Allison, hi.
Hi, I was just wondering, so my understanding, because I have an income-based repayment plan for my student loans, my understanding was that whatever amount of my loan is then forgiven after the 20-year period that they have me set up for will be that year added as income on my taxes. So say I have $20,000 left on my student loan, and that's forgiven, that $20,000 then would be added to my income for that year for tax purposes. So I was wondering, does anyone know if this forgiveness of $10,000 or $20,000 is going to affect people's income taxes for this year?
Allison, thanks for that call. Nick, please correct me if I'm wrong. I believe I saw that the forgiven debt under this policy would not be treated as taxable income, but again, correct me if I'm wrong.
You are correct, Rob. Yes, that's correct. The American Rescue Plan was passed last year, and in it, there's a provision that said that student debts that are going to be canceled until 2025, it expires in 2025, are not going to be counted as income on your taxes.
Thanks for the call, Allison. We'll go now to Greg with us in Sheboygan. Greg, hi.
I have a question, and I have a comment. When I first started in college, right after I got out of high school, I'm 68 years old, I spent $600 a semester, and that was two paychecks because it was 12-something an hour where I worked making level-air truck seats at Bostrom in Milwaukee. But and then it went up to, I think, $900 when I in 89, and now I went back for heating and air conditioning just to check the difference between standard and metric. I mean, heating and air conditioning is standard, basically. And it was $2,400 just for a semester. And I want to know why. The teaching didn't differ. I don't know. What is the cost? Why? How? Now, if you paid the teachers, they'd be all making $1 million. I mean.
Greg, I gotcha. Nick, Greg's experience, not unusual, that increase in costs happening in a lot of places.
Greg, I'm smiling over here because you're tapping on just a big fundamental problem that we're still trying to resolve, and it doesn't seem to be fixed. So we had an era of high wages and low tuition, you mentioned, Greg, and now we have an era of low wages and high tuition. We have just the opposite. And so the tuition continues to rise, especially in the public sector, for a lot of factors, but one large one is state investment in public higher education is either flattened off or not grown very quickly, or in many cases declined. And so the cost gets passed on to the consumer via higher tuition. So that's one part of the puzzle, but that doesn't explain everything. The other part of the puzzle, or one of the other parts, I suppose, is that the whole entire enterprise of higher education, think of universities and colleges and technical schools, they hire a lot of professional staff members, a lot of professionalized workers, and those salaries have not gone down over time. Those salaries have to be competitive with how salaries are rising in the private sector. And so those are all the conditions that kind of give rise to high tuition.
Greg, thanks a lot for calling in. And I got to say, Greg reminds me, Nick, that I think a lot of the conversation I see about this imagines a college student as somebody who goes to a four-year residential campus with ivy on the brick buildings and so on. Greg is an HVAC student. There are a lot of students out there who might have student loans for a wide variety of reasons.
That is absolutely right. And in fact, one of the things that is surprising to me is that students who have smaller loans, maybe enrolled in just a short period of time, maybe didn't even finish a credential, but now they don't have that to pay off in the labor force. And sometimes those low loan levels are actually the ones that students or borrowers struggle the most with. So they tend to default on their loans. And so the Biden administration is also working on clearing those defaulted loans. 7.5 million borrowers who are in default on relatively small loans are going to have their loans be put into good standing and potentially forgiven too.
Greg, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Talking to Nick Hillman, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison, looking at the Biden administration announcement on student loan debt. Back to your calls now. Pat is with us in Three Lakes. Pat, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I've got a question. How much of the student loans, what's the percentage of financed by private lenders versus government? And also, on the $10,000 and the $20,000, what happens to the private lender? Are they just out the $10,000?
Pat, thanks for the call. Nick, so two-parter here, private versus publicly funded or backed loans. Do we know how much is in each category there?
Less than 10% of the dollar volume of that $1.7 trillion I mentioned earlier, $1.6 trillion, about 10% of that is from private student loans. And those are usually lent out by banks or credit unions and so on.
And then Pat's second question, I guess, does this loan forgiveness apply to those loans that someone might have gotten from a bank or credit union?
It does not. So the debt cancellation that the Biden administration announced is for these federal loans.
Pat, thanks for calling in. Good questions at 800-642-1234. Anita joins us now in Lindenhurst. Anita, hello.
Hi, good talk. Now, I don't disapprove of helping out the student debt, but but I think that before we went and gave it out to all everybody that has a loan, I think priority should have been given to all of those, what would you call them, the nurses and the doctors and the EMTs and the staff that worked treating COVID patients during the very worst days of COVID. And they didn't get to see their, a lot of them never got to see their kids, their families, because they couldn't bring COVID home. They couldn't risk it.
Anita, thanks a lot for the call. Nick, I understand there are, there were already, I believe, some forgiveness plans for people who worked in, I think, healthcare, maybe teachers and some other professions. And I think in this new guidance from the Biden administration, they're trying to make it easier for people in those categories to actually get that kind of debt forgiveness.
That's correct. There is a specific program, and listen for this term, Public Service Loan Forgiveness, PSLF. And what that does is if you make payments for 10 years, then you can have whatever's remaining, principal and interest, canceled after that period of time. And the Biden administration has made some changes to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness program. It's sort of a temporary fix right now that gives more generous benefits. So it counts more time for borrowers to sort of have their debt forgiven. But they're going to try to make that more permanent. So public service loan forgiveness is one way to do it. I think, though, that the caller, and forgive me, I forgot your name, it taps into this question of who deserves it. And I think the politics of all of this are certainly right there in our face.
Thanks for that call, Anita. Sandra joins us now in Mount Pleasant. Sandra, hello.
Hi. Many people think this is something novel and new, but it isn't really. Back in the late 60s, I was in a four-year college in an education program, and I received a national defense loan, and albeit much, much smaller than what we're hearing of people owing today. But after I taught X amount of years, I only had to pay back half of the loan.
Interesting, Sandra. So Sandra's saying there's some precedent, Nick, for this kind of thing.
That is absolutely right. And that's something I've been thinking on as well. So is this kind of returning the loan program to its origins? Maybe so. Yes, absolutely. The national defense loans. And then over time, there have been several other service-oriented loans that get forgiven after a period of time. So yes, this is there's definitely precedence.
Thanks for that call, Sandra. Nick, I want to take our last minute or so to talk about, okay, some of this older debt is forgiven, but students are going back, you know, to school in the next few days and racking up new debt. Are there solutions in the works for, you know, not racking up that debt that we'll be talking about in 10 years?
There's not really a long-term solution here. And that's, I think, a big challenge with this. Now, yes, it benefits people immediately who took out loans prior to July 1, 2022. So if your loan was disbursed before that date, then you could be eligible. But after that date, you're not. And so it leaves a lot of big question marks about what's next. What about everybody else? And how are we going to solve these problems so that this doesn't happen again in the future?
That's where we'll leave it. Nick, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
Nicholas Hillman is a professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about this week's announcement that the Biden administration will be canceling between $10,000 and $20,000 of student loan debt for certain borrowers. We want to hear your story about student loan debt, especially if this change affects you or doesn't affect you and you're wondering why. Head over to WPR.org and search for the Why Sconson page, that's W-H-Y Sconson, and share your story there. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, Wisconsin has had a long-running shortage of public defenders. A new lawsuit says that's causing harm to defendants in the state. We'll find out what's driving that problem and look at some possible solutions along the way. Plus, we heard earlier this summer the Republican National Convention is going to come to Milwaukee in 2 years. Milwaukee's mayor, Cavalier Johnson, is going to join the show on Monday with a look at the possible economic impact. Plus, a preview of the November elections. Now that primary season is pretty much done, that's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.